This is Radio Boston. I'm Chris Sidorek. Today is the second day of the heat wave currently scorching New England, and it is even hotter today than yesterday. Just last hour, Logan Airport checked in at 98 degrees. Last time we broke triple digits was July 2011, so we'll see whether we get there this afternoon or not. But either way, the heat and humidity are going to stick around through tomorrow before cooler weather is finally expected to sweep in, of course, right before the 4th of July weekend. This is the second heat wave to hit the region this month, and much of Massachusetts are under heat advisories. Boston is actually under a heat emergency. And as we mentioned yesterday, it's the first time since 1941 that we've seen two heat waves in the month of June. There are currently 15 cooling centers open throughout the city to help Bostonians keep cool. And here to tell us more is WBUR's Quincy Walters. Quincy, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
All right, so before we really jump in, I've got to ask you, I know you've been out and reporting in the heat all day. How are you doing? And are you someplace at least somewhat cool at this point?
Well, Chris, I am chilling like a villain. No, I'm just kidding. But yes, I'm at home now. I don't think there was any way that I could do this interview outside.
Yeah, we try not to get the equipment too wet. So I understand exactly. That. All right. So you were out, though, all day. What did you see? And did you see people about? I was shocked on my, well, I guess not shocked, really. On my ride in this morning, though, there were folks running on the Esplanade. Did that continue as the day went on? What'd you see?
Yeah, I was surprised at the number of people who are out and about as well. I just got back home about an hour ago, but it seems like a lot of people were going into stores or restaurants or at least staying in the shade. I didn't see any sunbathers, although like those folks would be good to talk to. But of course, the Frog Pond on Boston Common was pretty packed. And that's where I saw the Smith family who were visiting from Virginia. And that's where they decided to cool off. And Rachel Smith says they were boiling looking for the oasis that is the Frog Pond for about half an hour.
So we did the duck boat tour, and then we walked over here to the gardens, and we're on searching for this water so that we could cool off.
And her five-year-old daughter, Riley, says that this was the hottest heat that she's experienced in her life, and that the Frog Pond is her favorite thing in Boston. And I don't think she'll have many critics there.
Yeah, that's for sure. I'm also thinking of all the folks who are basically have no choice, can't escape the heat, or stuck outside working or without AC in their homes. I know you've been talking to Bostonians throughout the day. We're on live radio, so you probably can't use all the direct quotes, but what were folks telling you about the heat?
Right. Well, a lot of people said it's hot. So, yeah, a lot of people who have been, I spoke to a few people who've been, you know, living here in Boston for decades, and they described the heat in terms of its intensity, in terms of, you know, how long it lasts, as sort of unprecedented. And I met 72-year-old Tom Cooper in the Boston Public Library on Boylston, and he says he's been here since the 70s, and today he couldn't even cool off in the shade, and he couldn't think of anywhere else to go other than the library.
I'm here at the library trying to stay cool on a real hot day. Can't stay here for ever, but I'm just hoping for right now just to stay cool at the present time.
And I did talk to somebody else at the library who said that coming to the library has become a sort of a heat wave ritual because she didn't have AC, but she ordered an AC recently and it should be coming in today. She said she'll probably come into the library still, but this time it won't be because it's her only option to stay cool.
Wow. You use the word unprecedented there. I mentioned we haven't seen two heat waves in June since 1941. What's the city doing to deal with the heat, and where do we go from here? All climate experts are saying basically it's going to be like this and continue to get worse, right?
Right, Chris. So we can't talk about the heat waves without talking about climate change. So earlier today, I spoke to WBUR's environmental reporter, Miriam Wasser, to get her perspective. And she told me that Boston, you know, is sort of working toward you know, climate resiliency and rising to the occasion. Their effort called Climate Ready Boston. And she, you know, read the report and she says that, you know, Boston is looking into things like, you know, planting more flora and investing in infrastructure that doesn't attract or radiate heat. But it also can be things like helping people pay for their electric bills who might not be able to afford to run their ACs. But here's Miriam.
You know, Boston right now currently experiences about a dozen days over 90 degrees every summer. And by 2030, we could see up to 40 days every summer that hit 90 degrees.
Oof. That's a lot of days over 90, man.
It makes my skin hot just listening to it. But, you know, the question becomes, you know, how do we stop or reverse this? And those are the questions that a lot of scientists are pondering. But sort of in the meantime, the most many people can do, like today, is just like try to stay cool.
Yeah, and we did speak to Sanjay Seth, who works with the city on climate resilience. You can find that on our website. That's WBUR reporter Quincy Walters. Quincy, always great to talk with you. Stay cool out there, man.
Likewise, Chris. Bye.
So all that heat means folks are probably searching for the nearest beach to keep cool, especially as we have the holiday weekend coming up. But here in New England, we all know summer and the ocean have a bit of a complicated relationship.
I don't think you appreciate the gut reaction people have to these things.
Harry, I appreciate it. I'm just reacting to what I was told.
Martin, it's all psychological. You yell barracuda.
Everybody says,
huh?
What?
You yell shark. We've got a panic on our hands on the 4th of July.
That, of course, is Amity Island Police Chief Martin Brody and Mayor Larry Vaughn talking about a great white shark in the 1974 hit movie Jaws, filmed, of course, on Martha's Vineyard. It's a Hollywood production, but we are seeing an increase of shark sightings around the Cape in recent years, and some folks are wondering, is it becoming more of a reality? So joining us now to spill all the secrets about sharks is John Chisholm. He's an adjunct shark scientist at the New England Aquarium. And John, I have to apologize right out the gate because I promised Amanda Beelen, who produced this segment, that I would say it's fantastic to have you here on Radio Boston.
Thanks, Chris. Happy to be here.
All right. So we know today the Atlantic White Shark Conservancy, which operates the Sharktivity app, previewed the beginning of shark season. We all know about Shark Week. Tell us about shark season. How long is it? When does it actually run? What time are we talking about?
Well, if you're talking about white sharks, we're talking basically July through December, with the peak of the season being in September and October.
All right. So that's interesting, because speaking of that Sharktivity app, there have been about two dozen sightings or so this month, and most of those in the last couple of weeks. What do you make of this? Is that an early start to the season? And what does that mean?
No, it's actually pretty much on track. I've been keeping track of shark sightings in Massachusetts since the 70s. And, you know, the sharks have always been here. We're seeing more now that the seals have come back and are attracting attention from the sharks. And there's more people on the water, and everybody has a cell phone, you know, which is basically a camera and a computer on in their hand, so that we get a lot more reports. But it's basically right on track compared to the previous years. You know, the sharks start to pick up in numbers right about now, so it's not unusual.
So that makes a lot of sense in terms of sightings. More folks aware, and like you said, have devices to kind of capture those sightings. I will say the Atlantic White Shark Conservancy held a briefing today and acknowledged during that briefing that there have been an increase in negative interactions between human and sharks in recent years. You mentioned the seals. Are there other factors contributing to that? And maybe what would you classify as a negative interaction between humans and sharks?
Well, a negative interaction is a bite. When someone gets bit or you know, knocked off a surfboard or something like that, that would be a negative interaction. And there have been several. You know, there was the fatality in Maine last year, and then going back a couple of years, the fatality down the Cape. So those are the negative interactions. And there have been more, but, you know, in the overall picture, it's still, you know, pretty low, you know, when you look at how many people go to the beach every single day. But it's, you know, we gotta raise awareness and, you know, do more public outreach, which is why, you know, they had events like today and why, you know, I'm here to talk sharks. You know, the more people are aware, the less likely there's, you know, going to be a negative interaction.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Sharks obviously have a pretty specific reputation. I'm going to play one more cut, and I promise this is the last cut we're going to play from Jaws. But I just, the description, I think, really speaks to how a lot of folks react viscerally to even thinking about sharks. So this is a scene where scientist Matt Hooper, who's played by Richard Dreyfuss, is talking about great white sharks.
What we are dealing with here is a perfect engine, an eating machine. It's really a miracle of evolution. All this machine does is swim and eat and make little sharks. And that's all. Now, why don't you take a long, close look at this sign? Those proportions are correct.
Love to prove that, wouldn't you? Get your name into the National Geographic.
So talk to us, John, if you would, a little bit about what sharks actually represent for the ecosystem. Are they this menacing threat that our society has kind of painted them to be?
No, I think most people realize that, even more now with the amount of, education with different shark programs and, you know, people seeing firsthand, you know, these sharks are here. But sharks, they're just trying to live their lives doing what sharks do. Just, you know, they have to eat, they have to reproduce to survive. And, they're just making their living out there. And whether it's a white shark or a mako shark or a sand tiger shark, you know, we have a bunch of different species in our waters, and, you know, they all have a role to play. Some eat, you know, small fish and crustaceans, some eat larger fish and marine mammals. And, you know, for the most part, they're just doing what they do. And every once in a while, we have that negative interaction, but it does strike that primal chord in our, you know, in our being that, you know, there's something out there that, you know, we can't control that, that, you know, can potentially, you know.
Yeah, it's we all hear that music in our head, right?
Yeah. And being in Massachusetts, you know, the Jaws.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of life imitating art.
Yeah.
It is, you know, ironic that.
I have to imagine, though, like most species, they must play an integral role in the ecosystem, right? If we remove them from the equation, the ocean would probably be in some trouble. You tell
yes,
us?
They all have their role to play in controlling the prey that they feed on. And, you know, when you start removing the sharks, you start seeing the impact trickle down through the food chain.
So folks who are swimming or at the beach for a holiday may not necessarily enjoy seeing a great white shark, but they are a protected species. I've got to imagine that scientists like yourself are actually encouraged when you do see sightings, right?
Yeah. Yeah. We definitely are seeing, an increase in sharks, but in other parts of the world, they're having the opposite. You know, there's a major decline in sharks, and it's, you know, great right now for us to be seeing this. It indicates that there's a healthy ecosystem, even though, you know, not everybody wants to see a shark at the beach. It is a good sign.
So I mentioned the briefing today from the Atlantic White Shark Conservancy. They were talking at that briefing about studying data and trying to basically predict when and where sharks will show up. I'm wondering, how accurately can we do that? Now, you mentioned you're kind of not surprised to see a certain number of sightings. So how accurately can we predict where they're going to be, and what else don't we know about them? What do you think are the most important things we should be studying?
Well, there's, you know, for every question we try to answer, we end up getting, you know, a half a dozen more. What we're trying to do is looking at patterns and behavior. Now that we have so many sharks tagged, we can, you know, look and see, you know, what sharks are at what beach, at what time of day, on what tide or what weather conditions. You know, people from the Center of Coastal Study are also looking at the geography of the region to see, you know, which beaches sharks are preferring, the time of year they're there. All that will factor into being able to say, you know, you're more likely to see a shark at X location on the X day when the, you know, weather is like this. But in theory, that, you know, sounds great, but it's really hard to do, because one thing I've learned from studying these sharks is just when you think you can predict something, they go and, you know, change it up.
They zig when you think they're gonna zag.
Exactly.
Okay, so we're going to talk later this week about there's been a pretty significant increase in drownings this year. So we're going to be talking about that on Thursday. But as we're talking about water safety and specifically folks heading to the beach and potentially being in the water as we're seeing increased shark sightings, how can folks stay safe? What should they do? And what's your advice for folks who may be heading to the beach this weekend?
Well, the best thing you can do is, you know, educate yourself. Read before you go to the beach. Read the shark safety guidelines. The Cape Cod National Seashore has an excellent page that goes over all the different recommendations as far as, you know, not going out too deep, you know, not swimming at dawn and dusk, stuff like that, not swimming where there's bait in the water. And one other thing, I've had to reiterate this to other people. A lot of people just, you know, see on the news and hear about the work going on off Cape Cod and think that the sharks are just off Cape Cod. But, you know, these white sharks that we tag travel all, you know, throughout the region, throughout Massachusetts waters, throughout New England waters, up into Canada. And then, you know, in the winter, they move south down off the southeast. So these guidelines aren't just for, you know, someone going to the beach on Cape Cod. They should be followed by anybody going to the beach, just so you're aware, so you're prepared, and, you know, you're less likely to have a negative interaction.
All right. That sounds great. That's John Chisholm. He's an adjunct shark scientist at the New England Aquarium. John, thanks so much for joining us. Really appreciate the time.
Thanks for having me.
One of the big issues facing the next mayor of Boston is how to fix the city's police department. The agency's got several problems right now. It's without a permanent leader, embroiled in multiple scandals, and officers are facing criticism for not just doing more to reduce crime. As WBUR's Ali Jarmanning reports, some Bostonians wonder if a new mayor will even make a difference.
It's a steamy Saturday afternoon in Grove Hall, the Boston neighborhood where Dorchester and Roxbury meet. People here are used to sirens, police stops, and yellow crime scene tape. But on this day, the folks hanging out in this empty lot browse books by Black authors as part of a Juneteenth book fair.
$18.
Jazara Pierre wrangles her toddler son as he pulls picture books off the table.
No, let's not put it on the books.
Like many in this neighborhood, Pierre doesn't give the department very high marks.
A D for effort. Because, I mean, again, 2021, we're still having to deal with a lot of BS that's just not humane and warranted in our community.
The mom from Hyde Park isn't comfortable calling the police when she sees someone in distress because she worries about what the police might do. And Pierre feels the problems with the police are so entrenched that it'll be difficult for the next mayor to fix them.
Honestly, I'm not that hopeful. If they put a commissioner in who's really all about making those changes, will he or she make a dent? Possibly. If one person can do it, go for it. Let's do it. But it's going to take a lot.
Boston has a police department in disarray. The police commissioner was fired over domestic violence allegations. More than a dozen police officers have been charged with overtime fraud. The former head of the police union is accused of molesting children. And the department has long faced criticism over whether it does enough to solve shootings in the poorer parts of the city.
I hope, you know, whatever your religious or non-religious tradition might be, that you have something like prayer, because you're going to need a little bit of a miracle.
That's Ray Hammond. He's pastor of Bethel AME Church and a member of BMA 10 Point, an anti-violence organization. Mayors, Hammond says, do have powers beyond prayer. They can choose the commissioner, set the budget, and then there's the bully pulpit.
I think they can set a tone. I think they can put in place policies that put folks on notice that corruption will not be tolerated.
Most of the candidates think that there should be a national search for the next police commissioner, something that hasn't happened since 2006 under Mayor Menino. And most support cutting police overtime and using the money to expand social services. The six major candidates also have a variety of other proposals covering everything from body cameras to police discipline. But Reverend Hammond says overhauling the department won't be quick or easy.
It's a little bit of a briar patch. Making change is hard. It can eat up a lot of your political capital. And you may not have a lot to show for it because it's a long-haul change.
Some local activists say past mayors haven't done enough. Jamal Crawford was part of the latest attempt at reform, a task force set up by Mayor Walsh last year. That group recommended a new civilian oversight board and a host of other reforms. Those changes have been slow going.
This is like, you know, getting people out of a cult, deprogramming. And people have to have the political will to get that done. And that's just to get the ball moving because it's still not going to be done overnight.
Of course, Boston isn't the first city to face these kinds of problems. One person who has worked with other troubled police departments around the country is Chuck Wexler. He's the executive director of the Police Executive Research Forum. He says some other cities in much worse shape than Boston have been able to fix things over time. And he's confident Boston can do the same.
You've got some internal issues there that have to be dealt with. And there may be some larger issues, you know, in terms of, you know, internal affairs and in terms of accountability. But certainly they're fixable.
Wexler says the most important decision the mayor faces is who will become the next police commissioner.
That is your key player in how that police department is run.
But many Bostonians wonder how much longer they'll have to wait to see changes that make a difference in their lives. Standing in the grassy lot at the book fair, Jazara Pierre runs her hands through her almost 3-year-old son's hair. She wonders how he might think of the police when he's older.
It's not going to happen within a year or two. It's going to take a long time, and I'm hoping by his generation he'll notice a difference compared to what we are dealing with now and then what, you know, the future generation will have to deal with.
Those running for mayor, though, hope to surprise people like her.
That report from WBUR's Allie Jarmanning. One of the voices you heard in that story was Reverend Ray Hammond, pastor of Bethel AME Church and a member of the Black Ministerial Alliance 10-Point Coalition. He joins us now to talk more about this issue. Reverend Hammond, welcome to Radio Boston.
Great to be here. Thank you so much. Good.
So I know you were a part of that story, but I'd love to hear, what's your reaction hearing that piece?
Well, I think I definitely agree with Jamal Crawford. We're talking about a long haul process. And the issue of police reform, like the issue of healthcare reform, like the issue of faith community sexual abuse reform, like the issues of medical malpractice reform, or et cetera. These are long haul culture changing processes, and you have to be in it for the long haul, or you're not in it at all.
It's interesting to hear you say that. I know this is an issue you've been working on for a long time. You co-founded the Boston 10-Point Coalition in 1992. How are you reflecting on where we are right now in terms of addressing this issue?
Well, I'm encouraged in the sense that I think we could be at an inflection point not unlike one I've seen before, about 30 years ago, not very close to the founding of the 10-Point Coalition. It was a combination of what I would consider the perfect storm of the Charles Stewart case in around 1990, the stop and frisk debacle that followed that case and that actually preceded it as well. And then the St. Clair report in 1992 that detailed the management failures and lack of transparency and accountability in the BPD. I really do think that set the stage for the introduction of community policing, not just here in Boston and other cities as well. In part driven by a succession of police commissioners. And I think it produced some real changes, but there is still a deep need for change in police culture, and not just a change in the police commissioner or even the command structure.
It's interesting seeing these echoes 30 years later. We just had so much back and forth over the last year or so. Massachusetts passed, I believe, a 129-page police reform bill. Some critics say there isn't enough teeth to that and that it's not leading to real reform. We've already seen a couple of deadlines missed in that. Are you hopeful that we are tackling this in a real way, or do you think that there still needs to be more honest conversation around these issues?
Well, again, I mean, I think we've put some important policies in place. I think this package of reforms was passed by the state. I think this Office of Accountability here in the city, all of these are very promising. But the again, the what I think we have to keep our eye on is the fact that a deeply entrenched multi-century culture has to be changed. It's got to be changed. And it's got to be not just, as I say, at the top, it's got to permeate and get down to the bottom roots. Now, there are a lot of things that go along with that. I think different kind of recruitment, absolutely different kind of training, a clear statement about who we are and who we are not. I hope we are not warriors. I hope that we are public servants who are partnering with communities to gain their own, you know, their safety, their security, their flourishing. I think there's a whole culture of accountability. Sadly, I think the police departments have gotten a pass, and it's only when you have these kind of multiple crises showing, you know, pretty significant corruption, whether it's sexual abuse on the part of police union leadership or all the things that were detailed in that report, that people step back for a moment and say, hey, we can deeply appreciate the work of the good officers, but there's real problems. There's a blue wall of silence that tries to obstruct investigations into misconduct. There's a lack of transparency. And there are a whole series of things, from qualified immunity to the lack of licensure, basic licensure for people who can deprive other folks of their life or liberty. So there's a lot that's got to be done, and I'm hopeful that this is the moment that we can begin to do it.
You mentioned accountability a couple of times there. I was looking back. The Boston Globe did a big look back at 4 years of data of complaints about interactions with the police last summer, and found that basically most of the time nothing happens, and there's, as you said, zero transparency in terms of resolving these complaints. Some of the most serious allegations, say use of force allegation, sustained 3% of the time. And it can take years for these complaints to be addressed.
Absolutely.
What does that do to the relationship with the community when they're at least?
I think it seriously undermines it. I mean, the notion that 3% of the time you're wrong. I don't know of any other profession that's got that kind of record. Mm. I don't know of any other profession that has that small a percentage of bad actors who don't need to be rooted out. I've been a physician. I'm now a pastor. And I am grateful that in the profession of medicine, we've had moments when the issues of quality concern and the cost in disability and lives of medical errors finally began to be addressed. And it's not over yet. I am grateful that in the case of misconduct, abuse, harassment, you name it, on the part of clergy of every faith tradition, not just the Roman Catholic Church, every faith tradition, that we are finally taking the covers off of behavior that has gone on forever and for which there was no accountability. I have no idea why police think they also shouldn't be accountable. When you carry a gun, when you have the authority again, by your arrest, by your interrogation, by your investigation or suppression of evidence to deprive me of life and liberty, you have to be accountable. So there's just a terrible culture in many respects within the departments. And then I think the surrounding society is finally just realizing that lack of accountability and transparency is bad for everybody. Most of all, bad for good police officers who are trying to do the right thing.
You talked to Ali about what you hope to hear in terms of tone from the next mayor. This is obviously an issue that's going to be big in the Boston mayoral race. Can you talk more about that and what specifically you want to see from Boston leadership?
Well, I think the next mayor has to continue, as I think mayors have, but you continue, and I think vigorously to again, support that Office for Police Accountability and Transparency, support the state post process, insist on better data. We should not have to wait weeks and weeks and weeks to get quality information about the conduct of police operations. The mayor, I think the next mayor has to be very clear that there will be an end of the blue wall and that they're going to do everything they can to counter what I think is very often, I'm not saying it's always true, but very often in police quarters, the kind of us against them mentality that sustains and reinforces that wall and that allows bad actors to get away. As I say, the greatest threat to good cops is not the public who pay their salary, but the bad cops who are bought off, who abuse the overtime system, who steal from the evidence room, or who knowingly send innocent people to jail, or physically or mentally abuse citizens. We got to do something about the influence of public of police unions, and I hope the next mayor will be willing to take that on. And we got to do something about qualified immunity, which is just another means of avoiding accountability.
You've talked about how this is a cultural problem, a deep systemic issue. How much influence do you think the next police commissioner can have over Boston Police? How important is that selection, and what would you be looking for?
I think it will be very important, because if the next commissioner comes in and simply wants to make the public feel better about their relationship with their police, there's all kinds of things they can do. I'm not trying to be, you know, negative or pejorative, but it'll kind of be window dressing. If you've got a police commissioner who understands that this is a moment, as I say, my assessment, not unlike the moment we faced 90, 91, 92, when practices really could be changed substantively, and a culture could be at least the beginning of changes could be brought about, and makes the most of that moment, gets the backing of the mayor, reaches out to the public for support, and basically makes an offer to the good officers. I want to stand with you, and we want to make this department something you can be proud of being a part of, something that is respected and appreciated for what it does. But that means together we have to change what has been. We've got to root out some people who don't belong here, and we've got to become real partners, not adversaries of the public we're supposed to serve. And every part of that public, every racial group, every gender identity, everybody has to see us as their partner.
We've talked about this issue a lot, especially in recent years on the show, and heard from a lot of different voices involved. One of those, Larry Calderoni from the Boston Police Patrolmen's Association, often talks about the fact that as this conversation is happening, officers don't necessarily feel supported, that they feel they're putting their lives on the line, and that if we're bringing in civilian oversight, that some of those folks might not understand what the job is actually like and what that decision-making process involves. What's your response to that sort of pushback?
Again, I understand the feeling. I heard the same thing from my medical colleagues when the issues around medical malpractice were brought up. I heard the same things from my clergy colleagues. Very few professions, almost none, accept accountability well. And they're rightly concerned that people who don't understand the kind of hard decisions that they have to make are going to be judgmental, are going to interfere, are going to make it difficult. And I understand for police officers, the fear is, it isn't just the loss of my reputation, or even maybe the loss of my job, could be the loss of my life. Got it. I would say there the key piece is you, like I as a pastor or as a physician or whoever, also have to educate the public. Here are the things that are at stake. Here are the life and death decisions we're making. Here are the challenges that we face. But again, it's going to be hard for people to take you seriously If you're not willing to root out yourselves, the bad actors, and the problematic approaches that every profession has, and if you're not willing to do that, if you're not willing to identify and deal with those things, the public has every right to believe that you are either just like those bad actors or you are enabling them.
I have... sorry to jump in. I have a ton more I could ask you, but we are running a little short on time. So I guess I just want to ask you, what do you want folks to walk away from this conversation thinking about as we move forward?
Well, again, I think we're at a pivotal moment. I hope good officers hear the cries for people to say, let's take off the plate of the police many of the mental health interventions. That's not what they're trained to do. Even much of the domestic violence work in a primary role. That's really not what they're trained to do, or school interventions or a number of other things. So my hope would be people wouldn't simply say that that's some version of defund the police. It's often people saying, let's ask police to do what they're trained to do. And then let's understand that as the public, we have a dual responsibility. We should support the police when they're right. And we should always be holding the police accountable so that if and when they're wrong, the appropriate action is taken and the people who are not good police officers are off the force. If they're guilty of crimes, they're tried and convicted and given the appropriate sentence.
Well, that's Reverend Ray Hammond, pastor of Bethel AME Church and a member of the Black Ministerial Alliance 10-Point Coalition. Reverend Hammond, thanks so much for the time today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Chris.
Even though Ticiana Deering is out today, we've still got you covered with another edition of Ask the Doctors. The big coronavirus news of the week continues to be the spread of the Delta variant. It's driving lockdowns in countries throughout the Asia-Pacific region. And in response, the World Health Organization has advised that fully vaccinated people should continue wearing masks.
People cannot feel safe just because they had the two doses. They still need to protect themselves.
That's Dr. Mariangela Shimao, WHO Assistant Director General for Access to Medicines and Health Products. And the mask recommendation is a split from current CDC guidance, which since May has told fully vaccinated individuals they don't need to mask up anymore. So how dangerous is the Delta variant and how should we protect ourselves and others as we prepare to celebrate Independence Day this weekend? Let's ask the doctors. You can call in 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK if you've got a question. Joining us today are Dr. Philip Landrigan, a pediatrician, public health physician, epidemiologist, and director of the Program for Global Public Health and the Common Good at Boston College. Dr. Landrigan, thanks so much for joining us.
Very happy to be here. Thanks.
And also with us is Dr. Sabrina Asumo, Assistant Professor of Medicine at Boston University School of Medicine and Infectious Disease Specialist at Boston Medical Center. Dr. Asumo, thanks for being with us as well.
Thank you for having me on.
All right. So we've got some real specific questions, but before we get into that, I really need to ask you both, where are we right now? Because on the one hand, we're seeing all this news about the Delta variant. It represents basically one out of every five cases in the U.S. We're told it's more serious, it's more contagious. At the same time, we know Massachusetts has more than 60% of the population vaccinated. We're seeing low case numbers. The seven-day average of positive tests is 0.29%, which is all-time low. So are we in a good place? Are we in a dangerous place? Where do we stand right now in terms of dealing with this pandemic?
I would say that we're in a very complex place. We're certainly doing a good job of pushing out the vaccine. Massachusetts has done a great job of getting down the cases. So far as we know, the current vaccines provide protection against the Delta variant. But we got to be careful. We got to be careful. I mean, there have been countries around the world that thought they had it beat, and now COVID-19 is coming back. And so I think that the idea of wearing masks when you go into a crowded place makes sense. Because little children under the ages of 12 have not been immunized, it makes sense to wear a mask when you're around little kids, even if you've been vaccinated. If you've been fully vaccinated, the risk of getting this infection is low, but it's not zero. And why take a chance? This is an infection that can kill you.
Dr. Asumo, what about you? How concerned are you right now?
So, no, I agree with Dr. Landrigan that we are actually in Massachusetts. We're in a great place. I mean, our numbers have never been this low. We've done a really great job of vaccinating a large portion of the population. But, you know, as COVID-19 has also told us, you know, it's very complex and a lot of it is local. We sit here in Massachusetts, we're doing great, but there are other parts in the country that don't have as high rates of vaccination. And unfortunately, that's where we're seeing the surges. And we also have to think about, you know, the fact that we live in a global society. You know, in some parts of the world, only approximately 1% of people have been vaccinated. So it is complex. I would say that the message is that the vaccines are safe and effective. And if you haven't been vaccinated yet, you have a great opportunity to do this and you should get vaccinated as soon as possible. But we are still at a time where we need to be cautious because these variants will continue to evolve unless we really work to vaccinate the world.
So how challenging is that mixed messaging? Because on the one hand, we're saying, okay, all the data we have shows that if you have the vaccine, if you're fully vaccinated, you are pretty well protected. On the other hand, things could spiral quickly and we should still be taking precautions. Those seem to not really fit together. How do we reconcile that?
Well, I think the answer to that is it's not a static situation. If this was a completely stable virus that didn't mutate, that didn't evolve new strains, then we could say no need in the world for a mask if you're fully vaccinated. But this is not a stable virus. The experience of the past 15 months has told us that this vaccine continues to evolve. Thankfully, up until now, the strains that have emerged are covered by the vaccine, but that's not a guarantee for future performance. So it's tough. And I appreciate that it's awful tough to communicate this complexity, this uncertainty, this mixed message to people, especially people who are tired, people who've been buckling down for more than a year. But this is not a good time to relax our guard.
So you mentioned the vaccine a few times there. We got some news on the vaccines today. There were some studies published in the journal Nature on Monday that seemed to suggest that the Pfizer and the Moderna vaccines could potentially protect us for years. Tell us a little bit about what we're learning and what that could mean.
Well, I saw that article. Of course, there's really no way to know that it protects people for years until years have elapsed. And right now, nobody has had the vaccine for more than about a year at the very most. So it's reassuring news, but it's not absolute protection.
Dr. Asumu, do you think we're still going to see the need for boosters moving forward or too early to tell?
I mean, it is too early to tell, but the two questions that we need to think about, you know, there are boosters that we're thinking about that would need to be administered because immunity has waned. So that's one question, and we need time to figure out how long it is going to take for immunity to wane, or is it going to wane? The second thing is it that we're going to need boosters because our variants have evolved, and so vaccination that were effective early on are no longer protective. But I might say that reviewing some of the data that are coming out, I feel very encouraged by some of the new studies that are coming out, especially that Nature article, because, you know, early on in the pandemic, we focused a lot on immunity waning and whether antibodies level were dropping. But what that Nature article did and some other articles that have come before it is telling us about durable immunity that evolves when our memory cells take over and are able to, you know, to sort of address any further infections that would come along. So the reassuring thing is that if you do get your two vaccines, your two mRNA vaccines, you know, you're likely to induce durable immunity that would continue to protect you for a long period of time. In terms of knowing for how long, we'll have to wait, but this is very encouraging news.
And we don't know where Johnson & Johnson fits in and all that, right? This is just the mRNA vaccines we're talking about.
Yeah, it is correct that a lot of the data that are available are for the mRNAs. But the encouraging thing, you know, whenever anybody thinks about Johnson & Johnson, I keep saying that, you know, Johnson & Johnson is able to do in one shot what you need to do in the with two shots in the mRNA, and we shouldn't forget that with the Johnson & Johnson shot, you get that you're able to induce, you know, T cells and memory cell, which is really important. And I would also remind our listeners that there's an ongoing study to figure out if you're going to need a booster of the J&J vaccine to sort of increase that immunity, because everybody remembers the 66% that was far lower than what we'd seen with the mRNA vaccines. But we have additional studies that are coming out. Hopefully they'll provide additional information, but the J&J is able to do what the mRNAs need two shots to do. So it is a great vaccine, and I want people to feel reassured.
So, Dr. Landrigan, you were the one, I think, that said we're in a complex situation. I think that's putting it mildly, because on the one hand, we're seeing, you know, the TD Garden is fully open, Fenway Park's fully open, folks are gathering by the thousands. And yet, listening to the two of you, it sounds like your recommendation for folks, if they're going to gather for a backyard barbecue this weekend, is that something folks should be masking to do, even if they're vaccinated?
I think it depends on who you're with. If you're with friends and family with whom you've spent a lot of time in recent weeks, and everybody in the gathering is fully immunized, then I think you can go without a mask. But if you're going into a public place like Fenway, where there's going to be hundreds, thousands of people, almost certainly some of those are folks who are not vaccinated, who may in fact be carrying the virus and don't yet know it because they're in the early stages of the infection, then there's the potential for spread. So it's a matter of having, I think what listeners have to realize is you have to have situational awareness here, and all circumstances aren't equal, and you got to judge the circumstances of where you're going to be and who you're going to be with.
Dr. Asumu, what about you? What advice would you give folks heading into the holiday weekend?
Yeah, I know. You know, the messaging has been so hard, and it's so hard to craft a good public health message, but there are just some key fundamental principles to remember. One of them is what I want people to remember is, you know, outside versus inside. Outside is safe. Like, if you have a decision, am I going to have a gathering at my house? Pick outside. And if you're outside and there's, you know, it's well ventilated outside, I think that, you know, you don't have to take as many precautions as you would need to do inside. So I would say let's recommend and make some suggestions for what we do know is our safer practices. So outside, I think it's fine if you want to have a barbecue. The thing that would be concerning if you're in a crowd, because that's when you would need to wear a mask. But if you're outside with a small group of people, I think that doing and having fun outside is safe. The second thing to think about is inside. So if you're inside, you have to think about, you know, who you are, what is your medical history, are you at risk for complications if you were to get COVID-19. If, for example, you're someone who's immunosuppressed, you know, and we do the data actually show that and for patients who have immunocompromising conditions that, you know, two shots may not be enough and they may need a third one and a booster. So you have to think about your own situation. You have to also think about who's around you. You know, do you have people, you know, do you have unvaccinated children who are around you? In these cases,
so much to think about, obviously. Yeah, Dr. Sabrina Asumu, Assistant Professor of Medicine at Boston University School of Medicine and Infectious Disease Specialist at Boston Medical Center. Thanks so much for being with us. And Dr. Philip Landrigan, pediatrician, public health physician, epidemiologist, and director of the Program for Global Public Health and the Common Good at Boston College. Dr. Landrigan, thanks to you as well.
You're most welcome. Thank you.
That's our show for today. I'm Chris Sitterick. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.